Welcome to Non-Consensus Investing. I'm Ram Ahluwalia, your host and CIO at Lumida Wealth, where we specialize in the craft of alternative investments. At Lumida, we help guide clients through the intricacies of managing substantial wealth so they don't have to shoulder the burden alone. Through this podcast, we draw back the curtain to reveal the strategies employed by the best in the business for their high net worth clients so that you too can invest beyond the ordinary.
All right, we're live. Pleased to host Ryan Selkis, founder and CEO of Massari. Massari and Ryan in particular is a real tour de force. You know, Ryan is building a business. I've seen him interview leaders in policy, in crypto, back to back at the Massari conference with no notes. He also has a small growing family like myself, so I can appreciate how you balance all that. It's a lot of energy. And Ryan, why don't we start off talking about Vivek? You know, you interview Vivek, and we'll cover other topics too, like Grayscale, the ETF wars, highlights from your crypto theses, the Fair Shake Pack, which I think everyone should be a participant of if you're going to speak at a crypto conference. There's a lot of ground we're to cover. We got 55 minutes. Let's start with Vivek. I know, you know, you had interviewed him. What are your impressions of where we are now?
I mean, I think he's great. I think he had the most articulate, thorough, pro-crypto platform of any major politician that we've seen on the national stage. I think he is 38. He's brilliant. He's technically savvy. He's eloquent. And I think he's going to have a tremendous future in politics. Now, obviously, you know, disappointed that that he dropped out of the race yesterday. We're filming this the day after the Iowa caucuses. And I think, you know, it is going to be a crazy year as presidential election years, you know, arguably always are. But I'm struggling to think of a year that was potentially crazier, more, you know, incendiary than a Trump Biden rematch after everything that's happened in the last few years. So you know, I'm not necessarily looking forward to that, but at the same time, I think you know, Vivek as a pro crypto proxy that will be, you know, campaigning for Trump, that is a net positive. And I think people have a misunderstanding of how the White House works. Joe Biden is not sitting in on every single meeting when it comes to economic policy, and certainly not when it comes to crypto, right? That's getting done by folks like Bharat Ramamurthy, who was a former staffer with Elizabeth Warren. He was really the driver at the National Economic Council that was putting forward some of these hostile crypto policies. And then, you know, members of the administrative financial, you know, regulatory apparatus, you know, these are former allies and close friends of Senator Warren. So, you know, presidents have allies, and those allies are usually very influential, depending on their area of expertise in terms of who is in these positions of power and then ultimately how those policies get enacted. There's a saying in DC, personnel is policy. So I think even for folks in crypto that strongly dislike, to be charitable, Donald Trump, the game at this point is not about whether you like Joe Biden or whether you like Donald Trump. It is how many pro-crypto proxies can we surround these gentlemen with on both sides so that we can ultimately have a fighting shot at good policy in the next administration, and particularly good regulation, without necessarily there being laws that are passed on a bipartisan basis that become law of the land.
Right. People are policy. And you had a great post the other day showing the policy positions under the current administration and the Trump administration. And, you know, Brian Brooks was an incredible win for crypto in many ways, not least of which was awarding Anchorage a national bank charter to engage in crypto activity. But it's been mixed, right? So Mnuchin went the other way, and Trump himself has said he's not a big fan of Bitcoin. And I claim that it was really Peter Thiel who had much to do with the influence of some of those positions. I would say
that's more Steve Mnuchin, right? I mean, that tweet was almost drafted by the former Treasury Secretary, who is no fan of Bitcoin. But that's exactly the point, right? I think the game now is to make sure that there is enough influential people in that orbit that ultimately are going to have the potential president's ear and you know, give him good advice about the, you know, the competitiveness of US tech and where crypto falls in that.
Really, the battle is focused on who would be Treasury Secretary under a Trump administration, because that role and person would set policy and play a key role in selecting all the other key personnel. As well, and as you know, there was a bargain with Biden and Warren in exchange for the endorsement. Warren set essentially a slate of regulators, including Chair Gensler. My read of what you're saying is that you don't expect that bargain to come undone. Therefore, focus on the other side of the aisle and focus on the right leadership that would be around to advance crypto policy. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I would also say there's plenty of Democrats and kind of career staffers that have been on that side of the fence within crypto that are working in-house or at lobbying firms at some of the different entities. So I hope that they have success if you know, Biden is reelected and there will be a new administration. Some people will carry over, maybe some alliances will carry over, but that will be a new administration and an opportunity to get new personnel in. I'm just not that optimistic about that side. So for folks that don't want to get bogged down in Trump versus Biden, you know, version two, I'd say the bigger battle is actually at the Senate. And that's where we can make more progress, because it does look likely, or at least the most probable events, that the Republicans could take the Senate, given how unfavorable the map is for Democrats. And ultimately, that would neuter some of Senator Warren's influence, because her influence over Senate banking, which oversees all the financial regulators, would now be in the minority.
Absolutely.
Instead of, you know, in the catbird seat that's actually you know, in control of these nominations from the Senate side.
So the Senate is the key area to focus on. What would you say the recent set of losses for the SEC and now the launch of the Bitcoin ETF means for rule of law?
That's above my pay grade. I think that look, anyone that's been paying attention to me for the last 2 years, 2.5 years, basically since the infrastructure bill, knows that I am disgusted at the way this financial administration, really, I mean, in general, things have been going the last couple of years, but specifically to crypto, the way that financial policy and the regulators have been acting is can only be described as going rogue. And trampling on the rule of law and basically turning, you know, many of these regulators into merit regulators and doing, you know, through the side door what they couldn't do through the front door. So I do think, you know, that's there's plenty of evidence for that. And the courts have agreed, and we see incremental evidence, you know, each passing day. I don't think that this SEC will approve an Ether ETF this year. I think that is, a long shot, to put it mildly. I just generally think that the SEC will force Grayscale and others to take them to court again. And any delay tactic that they can use will be employed. And the SEC's argument, I think, for blocking an Ethereum ETF could be with the implementation of staking and the change to Ethereum's consensus mechanism, it is now a bona fide security. So we're gonna, and actually this chart that you're pulling up right now, I think almost acts like a prediction market of sorts for whether this ETF will be approved. So if you start to see this this gap widening a bit, that's the market telling you that the confidence level is low that the SEC is gonna reverse course here. One dampener to that impact is that people, you know, could in the same breath look at this as a 9-month shot clock now until the election, where maybe this won't be approved this year and someone like Chair Gensler and that SEC will continue to be hostile towards additional products. But there's going to be a new administration. Right now, Trump is the marginal favorite, but that seems to be growing versus declining. And then the thought process would be, you know, will that Republican-led administration and set of financial regulators actually let some of these products through? So, you know, a lot of variables here, but I think it's a a great thing for the industry that we got this through the courts. I just don't think it should have taken 10 years.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I'm playing up on this slide here, the Ethereum ETHE versus the other trusts. So on the one hand, that discount has widened. I fully agree. It is like a prediction market in real time. The discount is now 15%, and that's increased from 7%, which is where it was last week. However, it still remains a bid. Part of that's the playing into the discount and betting that that will pull to par close at the time of an eventual ETF, which does seem inevitable. Either we get it this year or we get it next year through litigation. So on Ethereum, there's been a lot of discussion around, you know, the narrative of Ethereum. Is it straddled? You mentioned this in your report. I think you might use a different language than straddle per se, a little bit more polite. You know, from my lens, what I see is, one, there's a rotation that's taking place across markets, taking place in every market. You see that in big technology. You see that now in crypto. You have this worst to first dynamic and this first to worst dynamic. And then within crypto, you now have this narrative of eigenlayer, of restaking, which is another idea to really galvanize people around. And there's a big airdrop that's around that. People are excited and motivated there as well. You know, it seems to me like Ethereum is, you know, on the rise. You see that in the price action. You know, we saw, again, I just showed ETHE. Ethereum, I've been checked today, was at $2,600 not too long ago. Solana's down 20%. You know, what's your view on Ethereum now, given what you've learned since you published the report? Is it kind of the same view? And you took both sides of that as well. You say, here's my view on Ethereum, but by the way, there's a meaner version that could happen. And I'm more in the meaner version camp.
Well, I think we've seen that, right? I mean, I think when I drafted the report, you know, and kind of finished up the draft late November, early December, a lot of this divergence, it was, Ethereum was starting to underperform pretty significantly. ETHBTC was coming near, you know, all-time or multi-year lows. Solana was rallying, you know, particularly, again, off the back of the Breakpoint conference. So that was kind of already in process and it accelerated, you know, through the end of the year. And then at publication, I did in some of the other, you know, interviews and commentary say, you know, I'd expect some mean reversion. We've seen that this year. ETH's up about 10%. Solana's down. Bitcoin's flat. But it's not by much, right? So I'm not surprised by that in the short term. I do think in the medium term, though, Ethereum has a 60% market cap, market share for network tokens. Right. And this does not seem like a market where you're going to have a power law distribution in those economics versus an oligopoly. So it will look more like mobile phone operating systems or browsers or, you know, computer operating systems, you know, use your tech equivalent, than it will, you know, search engines, right? So I think that's really the bet on the field. In a declining market or a market where things are cold, with the exception of the macro narrative around Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin is going to outperform Ethereum. In a market where everything is on fire, Bitcoin might underperform Ethereum, but there's going to be faster horses in these long tail network tokens. And I think that's probably a pretty safe medium term bet, but I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't do a pair trade where you're going long short, because you can, you know, you can get blown out and that sort of thing, like in an instant. Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind is some of these other alternative L1s do have supply overhang. Maybe that's not directly included. Maybe it's technically included in the market cap, but there's some supply dynamic that whether it's, you know, liquid tokens that are held by a foundation or, you know, some type of vesting contract or anything in between. Ethereum is hard in the sense that it is net deflationary right now. So there is a supply dynamic and issuance dynamic that I think is, you know, at play.
Which right. Were you referring to Solana there in terms of the supply unlock in the horizon?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly. I'd have to go back and double check the numbers on Solana, exactly what those supply dynamics are. I think it's relatively low compared to some of the other emerging L1s, right? The assets that are just coming to market, the networks that are just coming to market in this cycle. You know, this is going to be true for Aptos, Celestia. You know, we've got a few network tokens that are yet to launch yet that I think will have the same issues. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because there's still, you know, single digit billion dollar networks versus, you know, Ethereum, which is, you know, closing on 300 again. But it's it is real on the margin when you're thinking about net dollars in. So right. You know, we'll see. But those are the dynamics that we're keeping an eye on.
Another observation is Kathy Wood recently made a point that she expects Ethereum would flip in Bitcoin. I was surprised to see her make that comment. By the way, she rotated out of GBTC into BITO. Of course, now she has her own ETF, so she'll rotate into that as well. But, you know, narrative does follow price, but price also follows narrative. You know, these things go hand in hand. Curious to see if you have any reactions on her comment.
The market will decide. Yeah, I mean, I personally don't see it. With the one caveat that Bitcoin's long-term security model is still up for discussion and debate in terms of how secure it actually is. We need to see a fee market emerge in the next, you know, 5 to 7 years for Bitcoin in order to make sure that there's adequate economics to the miners that are guaranteeing the security of the network. Otherwise, things come out of balance. And we are just entering that realm where Bitcoin miners are going to be incentivized to the tune of less than 1% of the assets market cap per year after this next halving. And that's, I think, maybe a real tipping point. We'll see how much lower that threshold can go. But at some point, the fees are going to have to catch up. Otherwise, you just have no real security.
Yeah, problem. A lot of dynamics around the miners. Obviously, they've been trading down this year. I expect that'll continue. Miners are the very best investment you can make in crypto. Last year, along with, well, Solana, you know, crypto is non-consensus, and the most non-consensus bet within crypto was Solana and the miners, and they did fantastic. But, you know, I think crypto equities would trade down if you've got a view on that. On ultrasound money, was that a distracting narrative for Ethereum? Leading question.
I don't know if it was a distracting narrative. I don't think it's as clean. Right. You know, I think it's very much a middle of the bell curve type of meme. But that's something that might arguably resonate really well with the Wall Street crowd that is just starting to think about what is the next asset. So if you're trying to attract financial flows and new investors from that cohort, then I would say Ethereum's narrative makes a little bit more sense. It's got this yield. It's actually used. It's net deflationary. It's got all these kind of fees that are being generated that you can almost model out what the economics of that, you know, on-chain company are, for lack of a better term. The switch to proof of stake, you know, makes it less energy intensive. So there is going to be a cohort of you know, financiers that are more inclined to support that and invest in that area than they will Bitcoin, just because of the narrative around proof of work mining. So yeah. I don't think that it was a distraction if you take the view of the world as larger than just crypto Twitter. It was certainly a distraction in the more insular community. And I don't think it's clean in narrative. So, you know, if you're broadening the pie and crypto is expanding its audiences, I still think that's a great positioning for Ethereum, but mostly on the investment side, not necessarily on the utility side, because the fees are still going to be much higher than what you'd expect in some of these other L2s, where you'd expect more of the value to leak, or some of the alternative L1s.
Right. I mean, I viewed it as a strategic mistake. Like, Bitcoin occupies the digital money space. It's got the Lindy effect. It's advancing on that. It's identified with that. And yeah, the questions, as you pointed out, around the security budget. Ethereum looks to me like a decentralized app store, although it's an imperfect analogy because it's also providing settlement and security services for, you know, other kinds of apps. And it captures a take rate like the Apple Store. Apple was the most valuable company in the world, still pretty darn valuable. And that to me seems like a better narrative to tell. It's like, hey, look, this is a growth stock. It's a platform play. Venture investors love the word platform play.
The issue is that the Ethereum platform's economics look more like Visa or JP Morgan in terms of fees. So the upside from there, if that is the valuation framework that you have, is 50%, not 5x.
It's higher multiple, but less fee capture, because the layer twos would own the end customer. But you know, I believe that.
But my point is, I think it looks more like Visa than Apple, if that's your lens of the world. I think that's where the competition of all of these other network tokens really comes in. And you know, what does that financial industry look like, right? Because what is JP Morgan's, you know, market share of banking globally? What is Visa's market share of payments globally?
Right.
That ultimately might be the cap on upside for Ethereum, because so much more of the value and so much more of the flows that happen on chain could leak into these other blockchains.
Well, this is a good segue into your crypto thesis, where you talk about tokenization. I'm very passionate about tokenization as well. You know, tokenization solves a problem of counterparty risk that got me excited about crypto, having lived and worked on Wall Street at 2008 at Merrill Lynch, which had a lot of issues around counterparty risk. And I'm going to quote from your crypto thesis here. Give me a quick moment. Okay, here you go. Say, if you believe as I do that blockchains are accounting innovations at their cores, then all assets will eventually be, quote, crypto assets that trade on public blockchains versus legacy clearing and settlement systems. Whether they are utility tokens or security tokens, over time, the Venn diagram of crypto versus TradFi looks more like a circle. So do you want to elaborate on that? It looks like in your view, you know, the coming together of TradFi and crypto, including the ETFs as one expression of that, is a good thing. And you expect more tokenization to happen.
I think the ETFs are almost the inverse of real world assets, right? I mean, real world assets are just kind of wrappers that trade on these, you know, on these.
TradFi tokenizing crypto instead of crypto tokenizing TradFi.
Yeah, I think crypto tokenizing TradFi is much more interesting, and that's where the puck is going, right? Yeah. These ETFs, I think, are really just a gateway drug to pull people, you know, from the other side over, you know, into crypto and actually just give them the exposure and the incentives to actually play in the sandbox. I think that the holdup has really been a distrust in public blockchains, right? Like, this is almost like the redux of the internet intranet debates of the 90s. I know that, like, oh, we're in 1993 or whatever. I'm not saying that. I'm not giving that like historical analogy for like what year is it in crypto. But I think the how did corporate entities think about corporate intranets,
right?
Where they had these walled gardens and you know, these you know, highly siloed, you know, technology stacks, versus like participating in the public internet. And right. And I think if you look back to 2014, 2015, Bitcoin got cold. There was this whole narrative around blockchain, not Bitcoin. 2018, 2019, it was, well, ICOs are interesting, but security token offerings are really, you know, significantly more interesting. Sure. That's what we should be thinking about in terms of like clearing and settlement and you know, all these distributed ledger innovations. The buzzwords have changed. I think this time around, though, the difference and maybe the thing that makes real world assets actually stick is going to be crypto wealth diversifying into traditional financial products versus crypto entrepreneurs trying to wrap a financial product with a, you know, kind of token wrapper and trade it on chain. It's basically push versus pull, right? We're in a much better position now that there's, you know, magnetism to this instead of just trying to push on a string, right? I think, you know, Wall Street is going to be heavily incentivized, and these asset management firms and kind of financial product you know, creators are going to be incentivized to build on-chain instruments, because when I sell a token, I keep it in stable coins on Coinbase. Like a lot of people do. So the way that you'll be able to monitor whether real world asset, you know, and tokenization is really blowing up, the first data point that you're gonna wanna look at is the net stablecoin market cap and what direction that's going over time. But if you start to see that start to tick up higher and higher again, and you know, cumulatively, like that is the reserve for crypto wealth. And then that will ultimately get redeployed, not just in dog tokens, but in actual like yield bearing, like bona fide, like tokenized treasuries, right? And so that's how it starts. And I think it, you know, it continues to ripple out from there. But Wall Street will look at that 200 billion or 300 billion or kind of wherever the threshold gets in the cycle. And they'll look at that as dry powder that should be deployed, that, you know, some of that might get redeployed into crypto assets, but that there's a whole slug of it that's just waiting to get deployed into treasuries or, you know, kind of cash interest bearing accounts, you know, whatever it is. And then ultimately stocks and bonds and
I fully agree. Yeah, Franklin Templeton, BlackRock around the case offering or tending offer various money market funds. So no, that's happening. It's a new market. You get direct relationship with your end customer. There's no intermediation. BlackRock doesn't want the counterparty risk from 2008. It's great. It's a great thesis. One thing I would point out though is that the SEC and current regulatory framework around securities laws are an impediment to broad-based tokenization, right? I can't do a crowdfunding campaign to go finance, you know, the next Taylor Swift, for example, because it fall under Reg CF and these antiquated crowdfunding rules. So that's something I just want to highlight to people's attention. And I don't know why the Blockchain Association and Coin Center are not focused on this. And the bank regulators, you know, Michael Hsu is the comptroller of the currency. He runs the most significant national bank regulator, the national bank regulator, the OCC. And he's given half a dozen talks over the last 6 months where he gets tokenization, but he wants it on a centralized chain, not on a decentralized chain, which defeats the purpose. I mean, if you want that, you can use a database. You know, we wrote an op-ed at trying to advance the intellectual debate, but do you have a sense of like, why aren't the policy associations focused on this? If we win on tokenization, if we put not just money on chain, stable coins, but we put yield bearing assets on chain, we put culture on chain, put syndicated royalties on chain, we put brands on chain where people relate to, have a relationship where they have emotional connection with, then the battle for the ideals of crypto are won. Then the snowball starts to roll.
You're giving policymakers way too much credit. There's no imagination in DC, and the average age in Congress doesn't allow for this type of imagination. So I just don't think, you know, when you think about where the policy associations are spending time, I mean, it's basically just holding down the fort until, you know, the beatings.
Until the next election.
Yeah, until the next election. You know, honestly, I think the best case scenario is not, you know, positive pro-crypto legislation. The best case scenario would be ongoing overreach by the SEC and ultimately a Supreme Court decision that completely eviscerates the SEC and basically takes it back.
That's really, you want litigation.
Well, I'm not saying that's the most likely path. I said that would be the best case scenario, right? Because you would essentially, radically limit the scope and the authority of the SEC in terms of what they were able to do and frankly, the damage that they were able to do to the economy just through their very existence. So I don't think that is likely, but to your point, there's only so much innovation that we're going to have until either the SEC is slapped down pretty significantly by the courts or you have some type of positive bipartisan legislation, but having a half-hearted, compromise that just further empowers and emboldens the SEC and creates more paperwork and red tape doesn't really do anything, and it doesn't kind of fully, you know, unleash the innovation that we could see otherwise if we were just starting from a blank slate.
Well, the emperor bleeds, right? So that scene in 300 where they throw the spear. You're a 300 fan, of course you are, right? So, and you see the blood and then people's perception changes. We haven't seen this kind of litigation with the SEC.
I think, going back to your previous question, I think when I was vocal about some of the overreach in 2021 and 2022, people thought I was crazy. And I am a little bit, but I also know when someone's acting in bad faith, right? I think that the flagrant dishonesty and manipulation and bad
come in register, especially I think
that this particular SEC has taken is something that is very widely accepted at this point. People might not talk about it as vocally, but I think that there is there has been this moment where the 300 analogy works, because you've seen more traditional finance firms push back on the SEC as well, right? This is not just the crypto
craze. Beyond crypto, no one's happy with the SEC.
It is far beyond crypto, and I think that the SEC has lost a ton of credibility. I actually think that the ETF approval itself was another credibility crushing event for the SEC, in the sense that you had the two democratically appointed commissioners alongside Gensler that were not forced by the courts to agree and kind of pass that ETF. They essentially went directly against what the courts had said and ripped up a legal precedent and said, it doesn't matter what the courts say or what the statute says. You know, we have now taken it upon ourselves to be a merit regulator, and we've kind of come up with all these arguments why this is a bad thing for the economy and for, you know, the public interest. That's not their job, right? But it does kind of show you the direction that some of these administrators are going and how the regulatory state is trending right now. So full circle, right? That's obviously why I'm, and people know, I've been of a vague supporter, and he's spoken about this quite a bit at length. I think the issue, though, is that is no longer a radical idea. And the overreach from that administrator, the overreach from the FDIC in pursuing choke point 2.0 and right. You know, basically assassinating some of these crypto-friendly banks in March. I mean, these are just things that happen. They're on the public record. You know, even Barney Frank from Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill author, called out publicly and said that Signature was shut down because it was too friendly to crypto. You know, these are not just kind of tinfoil hat conspiracy theories. I think that there are really deep rooted problems at the SEC and some of our financial regulators that are only going to be solved through the courts or through a change in control and political parties.
And some of that was driven by the fact that they had received donations from SBF, and there's an allergic counter reaction to that and to create distance. And what was not anticipated was the recovery in crypto assets that was so sharp.
Yes.
And the mobilization. You know, they might have anticipated that the public would vomit crypto or reject crypto, and that didn't happen. In fact, if you're in the Gemini Earn or Genesis Bankruptcy, FTX, you want in-kind assets. You do not want to be dollarized. It was a miscalculation.
Here's the difference. And the most vocal and strongest minority usually wins. Most people that don't like crypto don't understand it. And they'll say at a cocktail party, I don't like what it does for the environment, or they'll have a Jamie Dimon
said he doesn't like it, so I don't like it. Right.
Yeah, they'll have a Jamie Dimon level understanding of, like, you know, this is only good for, you know, terrorism financing and money laundering. And then they'll never think about it again, right? And that's about as deep as they go. There's not a lot of power in that offhand comment and dismissal. But for folks that are in the industry, and, you know, you're coming after my livelihood, we're going to come after yours at the polls, right? I think that is, you know, there are battle lines that are being drawn that are very real, that are, you know, very high stakes. But, you know, someone like me and, you know, someone like you, we're not going to back down from these positions, because this is literally the companies and our teams and our families that we're talking about, versus someone that just, you know, read, you know, a one-liner in a Wall Street Journal or New York Times article and has suddenly made up their mind that they don't like this technology.
Right. Do you want to talk about Fairshake? I think it's a good time to get active and get engaged and focus.
Sure. So I'd say there's probably four policy related. I mean, there's several others, but I'd say that there's four policy initiatives that people should be aware of. One is the Stand With Crypto, more grassroots oriented campaign that Coinbase helped stand up and is now an independent nonprofit that's focused on activating voters in some of these, you know, key congressional districts and key states. The second is the Blockchain Association for your company, right? They're the top trade association and kind of member-based org. If you know, folks that are listening want to apply there to support that lobbying effort. Coin Center, obviously, I would put in more of a, like, constitutional vanguard bucket. So they're, I've always compared them almost to the Night's Watch. If you're a Game of Thrones fan,
sure.
The fight for King's Landing, though, that's where fair shake comes in, right? So this is, you know, real brass knuckle electoral politics. This is a team that had a lot of success in the midterms with a 10% budget that they have this year, and ended up being, you know, very effective in getting a new crop of pro-crypto candidates through, you know, a number of congressional races. I think they went 18 for 19 in the general in terms of supporting kind of new candidates, and those candidates, you know, have a really big long-term impact on the trajectory of Congress and how crypto-friendly it may be in the future, because incumbents have a 90-95% win rate, right? What we didn't have last time that we do this time is, and I say we, you know, I'm not directly affiliated with them, although I've known the team and supported them, you know, for quite a while. But I think the thing that we as an industry have this time that we didn't have last time is a war chest that is considerable and can actually target some of our biggest opponents as well. So not just finding those open seats and open races and playing in the primaries and trying to get the best pro-crypto person on the Dem side and the Republican side, but we actually have the firepower now to be a deterrent on the one hand, or directly target some of our, you know, top adversaries. So Sherrod Brown in Ohio, John Tester in Montana being, you know, two of the big ones, but there are certainly others that you know, can be targeted and likely will be targeted now, thanks to the fact that, you know, we've actually got our stuff together and our, you know, have our backs against the wall a bit. So it's high stakes, but I think it's been a great addition to the crypto policy team and the kind of movement that we have down in DC, and it came not a moment too soon.
Yeah, no, look, I agree. I think, you know, policy matters. It has impact. If you think about crypto as moving money, storing money, programmable money, cross-border money, peer-to-peer money, merchant-to-peer money, all that impinges on half a dozen regulators, dozen different laws, from Bank Secrecy Act to USA Patriot Act to OFAC. So, you know, policy matters, and that's the unlock. You have to get alignment and congruity between the vision and mission of crypto and what that means for human freedom and human sovereignty and what that means for the unlock, you know, of the sector. So, you know, in the bear markets, people focus on policy and we talk about blockchain. When the bull markets, people forget. Otherwise, you're going to have that upside cap at some point.
Yeah.
I think crypto is disruptive and revolutionary in the sense that it kind of brings us back to where we were 30 years ago, right? From a civil liberty standpoint. And, you know, we've just ceded too much ground. So I do, you know, I think on the one hand, there is a perception in DC that the crypto community, I don't think from all corners of DC, but I think from you know, some wings, that the crypto community is very obstinate and difficult to deal with and doesn't care about some of these issues. Of course, we don't want terrorist financing. Of course, we don't want North Korea stealing, you know, stealing our assets through these hacks. I mean, you know, crypto folks are victims, you know, in some of these hacks. You don't want to see this tech used for ill, but historically, the way that you catch bad guys is to catch the bad guys and do the legwork to spot illicit activity and actually, you know, not just have dragnet surveillance that is going to treat everybody as guilty until proven innocent.
Right.
And crypto almost, you know, returns us to that norm where you can trace all of these transactions in open ledgers, but it changes the balance of power so that people are innocent until proven guilty again. And because it's so decentralizing, you'd have to literally go and trace every single address and every single self.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean, analysis and TRM labs that's out there helping.
Yeah, and so obviously powerful people in DC don't like that, but
right.
I think we've given way too much deference to a federal system that has failed, right? You know, these technologies are political, in the sense that they're, you know, reestablishing norms around civil liberties and constitutional.
They reference rights. They reference rights. They are digital rights.
They're digital rights, and the reason I have been so vocal in the policy scene in DC you know, you'll hear some people say, well, the industry will just get built offshore and internationally. That's not true. I mean, the US, if you're going to stage and mount a defense for a new technology, you want to do it from the nation and within the system that actually has some of these highly aligned protections, like encoded in our rule of law and our like founding documents. Absolutely. Right? It's in the source code of the US. And a lot of that source code is very similar and I think complementary to some of the values that you know, crypto already espouses.
I mean, the concept of decentralization is the ethos of the American Republic.
Yes.
And the separation of powers and the enumeration of powers. So like code of law, enumerated powers is the concept of code is law.
Yes.
Here are the functions and subroutines that are authorized by the US government. And the idea of dispersing decision-making to the margin from the state down to the local area, ultimately to the public square, if not a family or an individual, where they have accountability and they bear the benefits and burdens of a decision. So, I mean, that's the premise of decentralization. It really is core to.
Yeah, I struggle with this all the time. And you know this because you know, we catch up offline a bit too. But I struggle with this all the time because I do think I posted something a few weeks ago, Ram, where self-image versus public image. I had the side-by-side of William Wallace from Braveheart on the one side, like self-image, and then the crazy
Irishman.
Crazy Irishman, the knife.
Great movie too, another good one.
I think there's you know more than a kernel of truth there, but I just think we're way too deferential to a set of institutions that are clearly underperforming. Like we all know it. You see what Congress's approval rate is. You see what the White House's approval rate is. You see what the financial regulators' approval rates are. You see what the, you know, the red tape that we have that kind of throughout the country that we have to, you know, kind of carve through. And you see the age in Congress, right? Like just everything is essentially going the wrong direction. And yet there's this expectation that we're just going to genuflect to the masters in you know, the you know, Maryland suburbs
the great paradox of decentralized technology is that leadership matters more than ever.
Yes.
And you need focal points for leadership. You need centralized focal points of leadership. And you listed four of them.
Yeah. And look, I think that we should be solving root cause issues as best we can, both cleaning up our own house and then making sure that these technologies are used as a force for good. But, you know, there's no good the Patriot Act doesn't work, right? We haven't gotten into fewer wars because of the Patriot Act.
It was meant to sunset when it was passed too. It had a built-in sunset.
There's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. Right? So like, you know, it's up for discussion and debate and potentially a Supreme Court challenge, whether the third party doctrine that underpins so much of this financial surveillance in the first place is even constitutional.
What Ryan is referring to there is the ability of a third party to access, you know, name information on a sender of funds over X dollars, which one would presume be protected by Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure, and you know, that's private information. But that battle was never contested by the banks, partially because the banks are regulated by the executive.
Well, the real issue is the third party doctrine is the loophole here around the Fourth Amendment, because if your assets or your data is on a third party platform, then you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. A peer-to-peer financial system, a peer-to-peer set of technology changes that. And that's where I think some of the pushback is. But it's, you know, this this idea that this is revolutionary as a concept or you know, anarcho-capitalist or you know whatever you know term they're going to throw at us as a slur. No, it's just it's a return to you know constitutional protections that are now as well as the rule of law. So but you say this out loud and right, you know, it's you're considered a renegade if you get into like a corporate setting, particularly in you know traditional finance, because these banks are appendages of the state and like they're essentially you know government subsidized monopolies. And I don't mean that in a, we don't need the banks, like abolish all the banks, you know, occupy Wall Street way. I just mean that quite literally in terms of how they make money, right? And kind of where their incentives are and what the composition of their workforces are, right? These are predominantly legal and compliance run entities that have, you know, some financial markets experts and some back office technologists, but they're not tech companies. They're not actually, you know, innovators so much as entities responsible for system stability and you know, doing what the government ultimately says that they have to do.
Right on. It's great. I get excited about political philosophy. Look, there's just a lot of complacency. I mean, the Declaration of Independence and constitutional promise and the idea that rights precede government and we, the people, create a more perfect union to secure our rights. And that's the premise of the American Republic. It's not that rights are given by government. They already exist and we secure them. And we decide to advance beyond a civil society by creating institutions to help govern and secure them and enforce the law. So this is like, this is what you learn. You're supposed to learn in grade school, I guess. I don't know. People have lost sight of some of that. Well, let's shift back to the thesis. So I love this chart that you shared here about the Kaiko liquidity versus market cap. I think it's a real great alpha drop. And you also mentioned that if you use this framework, you could back into some of your tokens that you own. You know, you're loath to disclose all of your tokens. I think maybe a handful of them. I'm going to go guess that it's Bitcoin, ETH, Doge, Filecoin, Solana. I'm missing one probably in there. You can wink twice if I'm in the right direction. But in any case, do you want to walk us through what this chart is telling us? The liquidity.
I think that was shockingly accurate, to be honest with you. But the basically what this is, Kaiko does a really good job of this. Kaiko is a partner of Messari. We use them as one of our data sources for aggregating all these different, you know, market data feeds. Crypto is unique in the sense that liquidity moves from decentralized exchanges to centralized exchanges. Every pair is different. Every single exchange globally can list an asset, and you know, where that order book density lives, really just, it does change on an asset to asset basis. And sometimes on a month-to-month basis because of, you know, how liquid the system is and how easy it is to be a port assets from one exchange to the other. Very different from New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, right? You list as a public company on one of those exchanges for a reason. That's kind of where, you know, a lot of that activity ends up centralizing. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, something like the New York Stock Exchange, you know, and ICE is arguably more of a data company than it is a financial services company. If you look at how they make money as a business. A little bit of a digression, but essentially what this chart shows is what the liquidity ranking is versus the market cap ranking. And so the orange here is what the liquidity rank is. So in other words, you know, how little slippage there is, how much you know, real volume there is that would allow for, you know, high volume trading or you know, large order sizes relative to the market cap. So you'll see something like Arbitrum or Filecoin, as you mentioned, you know, anything that has an orange or gold dot that is to the left of this diagonal blue line, that means that there's more liquidity for those assets than there is, than is reflected in the current market cap. So this isn't a perfect proxy, but I do think as you look at the top assets, and I think they do these for 50 assets on a quarterly basis, when you look at this, this is probably a good proxy for where institutions and liquid funds will ultimately be able to play as the asset class matures. These will be the assets that they're able to you know, roll their sleeves up and actually add exposure to first. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen anytime soon. Again, not an investment recommendation, but it's a good shorthand that I'd love to see back tested.
I like it a lot. You know, one of the things that we do at Lumen is we look at the most liquid pairs on Uniswap. And it's a very similar concept at what you're getting at. And you can see emerging themes and narratives before they're out there in the open. So I thought that was a great alpha drop. I know we have a few minutes left. I'm also pleased to share we're teaming up with Messari, Lumida Wealth, I'm sorry, provide institutional investment capability to DAOs, right? So DAOs are growing their assets again. They're becoming more engaged. And, you know, we at Lumida, we're bringing that institutional endowment style investing That includes non-custodial investing, working with L1 advisors so the DAO can control their tokens. And then for public equities, we rely on Schwab. There's no trust requirement on Lumida. You have control over the assets. And Messari provides the analytics. And Messari's got the best analytics in town. We're going to see Messari.ai soon. We use that product every day. It is a killer application. It's how I got to know Ryan initially. Actually, I reached out to Ryan on Twitter. I was like, hey, can I invest in Messari? Cold DM. So we're excited to be teaming up with Messari to really level up the quality of investing in the category.
We're excited. Details to come. Obviously, we do a lot of quarterly reporting and analytics for many of these communities, and it's a good match, especially because we have no interest in ever registering with the SEC. So,
We wrote a critical op-ed against Gensler, but we also co-authored it with the former SEC chair Arthur Levitt. So it helps.
You're covered.
You have the boxing glove. There's a weight in there, but it's kind of softened a little bit.
Yeah.
Ryan, this has been a real treat, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. And most importantly, thank you for your leadership. Keep it up. Until next time. Take care.
Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you for listening in on the episode. Remember, in the world of investing, the road less traveled often leads to the greatest rewards. I'm Ram Ahluwalia, your host and chief investment officer at Lumida Wealth, where we specialize in the craft of alternative investments. Invest wisely, stay ahead of the curve, and stay non-consensus.